Hello once again. In this week's podcast, Ben Gutteridge, Bruin Head of Fund Research, speaks to Johnny Delahaye, co-founder of Tosca Fund and lead manager on the Aptus Global Financials Fund. The conversation begins with some analysis of the political turmoil in Italy and the impact it's having on the European banking sector. And here is what he has to say about the effect Italy has on European monetary policy.
Look, if Italy is bad, Draghi can't do anything. I disagree with that, because I think that Italy will resolve itself.
For more of that and a discussion on how the Indian market is dealing with an isolated, at least for now, bankruptcy from an infrastructure scandal, and a brief glimpse at the opportunities in the US and UK, please continue to listen. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone, welcome to the latest Bruin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're going to be talking financials and financial equity, and we're delighted to have on the show, offering expert opinion, Johnny Delahaye, of the co-founder of Tosca Fund and among other mandates at Tosca Fund, the lead manager on the Global Aptus Financials Fund. Thanks very much for joining us, Johnny.
Thanks for having me.
There is absolutely no doubting your credentials as a fund manager. You know, the Aptus Global Financials Fund's got a fantastic long-term track record, but there is no doubt the summer months, or Q3, if you like, has been a bit more problematic. You've been involved in the European banking trade, which has come under some pressure. So I think we'd like to explore that a little bit in this conversation. And perhaps you could sort of lay out why you believe there is upside in these shares, and you know the explanation for, I guess, why the banking sector has been unfairly treated.
Sure. Look, I mean, the trade in European banks was working very well last year, and the fund performed well on the back of that. There were a number of big capital raises, which were, in my view, sufficient to enable the banks to offload material amounts of NPLs. As we came into this year, there was then a period where people believed that interest rates were going to rise again, gave a good boost to the sector. However, over the summer months, two things I think have clouded the sector. One is some concern about economic growth in Europe, and the second one is Italy. Regards economic growth, I actually think the underlying data, though soft over the summer, has rebounded quite nicely. We tend to look at data like loan growth, house prices, and we can see some pretty nice numbers coming through there. If you look at wage inflation, that's nearly 3% in Europe currently. House price inflation is 3-4%, and loan growth is 3-4%. So for me, the underlying economic situation, though soft, previously seems to be rebounding.
I mean, it's interesting. Draghi talked quite hawkishly over the summer, but the market seemed to dismiss him as being...
Absolutely. And that was really came down to the Italian element, which is that people then said, look, if Italy is bad, Draghi can't do anything. I disagree with that, because I think that Italy will resolve itself. Clearly disappointing that the political situation has got to where it is now. But maybe not that surprising, given the populist nature of the incumbent government. I look at it rather similarly to maybe the US situation with Donald Trump, where he pushes as hard as he can at every avenue that he sees, with the sort of view that he can later pull back and claim victory. And I see the Italian government very much along those lines, that it would have been sort of remiss of them in some ways with their voting public to have not pushed. And we're now in that period where they push against the European community and hopefully over the next few weeks, and it may take until the end of the year, there'll be some agreement which will work for both sides. I do think that Italy have to pull back a little bit from where they are today, but I don't think it's also in the EC's view or aim for to put Italy under too much pressure that we see a huge increase in spread. So I think spreads of 300, 400 basis points is about sensible for where we are at this point. I suspect that as we get through the end of the year, that they'll drift back probably towards 250. I suspect we won't get back to 150 anytime soon.
I mean, there's a lot of sort of game theory in this negotiation between Italy and Europe. Certainly, Italy is not Greece. Italy is a big player and could cause a lot more headaches for Europe on a disintegration theme. But I guess if the European Union, European Commission do concede to Italy's marginal increase in demands for budgetary spend, then they open themselves up to perhaps attack from bond vigilantes that could send bond yields higher, or other economies wanting to be more expansionary. So there are potentially negative outcomes that may mean they're a little bit more stubborn.
I do believe they will be stubborn. I don't think they're going to roll over tomorrow. I just think there is a nice halfway position which gives Italy a bit more than you may have guessed they would have got a few months ago or even a few weeks ago, but not to an extent that goes to exactly as you say, that creates issues elsewhere. Now look at, and I think the thing worth remembering here is that debt to GDP in Italy is around about 130%. Now, with the assumptions they've made over the budget, we can all argue about the economic growth part of that, which seems quite high. That number stabilizes roughly where it is. I mean, under the Italian government's plan, they suspect that comes down to 126. I think that's unlikely. But this isn't the budget deficit the debt in the country going to 140 or 135, which I think would then absolutely open you up to bond vigilantes and the spread remaining high for a very long period of time. So I think we come to a compromise. Obviously, you've got elections in Europe next year, and everybody's very aware of that, positioning themselves ahead of that, both the EC and the Italian government. So as we go through the end of the year, my view is that we get that compromise, and then people refocus on two things, which is the opportunity in the bank sector. One is a micro element, which is that the balance sheets of these banks are getting cleaned up very, very quickly. And I actually think they've been cleaned up quicker than even a relative bull like myself assumed. There have been very, very large NPL sales over the last few months. Even in the sort of height of the crisis, a number of banks sold multi-billion dollar portfolios, principally to private equity companies, but also to real money and hedge funds. So I think that part has gone well, and I think that will continue into 2019. So the sort of cleanliness of the banks will be seen, which I think will lead to a re-rating. And then the second element goes back to your original point about interest rates. I think that allows people, if Italy is okay and the banks are seen to be cleaning themselves up, I think people will refocus on interest rates. And if the economic data remains relatively resilient, I think it's hard to believe that the ECB will allow rates to remain negative. And that's a really important point to remember here. This is not about raising rates from zero upwards. Rates in Europe are effectively negative. Euribor is minus 33 basis points today. So my belief is that at some point in 2019, that moves to a neutral position, and that is a huge impact to the banking sector from a profitability point of view. Just going back into positive territory would increase earnings for many of the banks by 15% to 25%, which is a similar thing that you saw in the US 2-3 years ago, and the result of that was the US bank sector performed extraordinarily strongly.
Okay, so there is a we don't need to see some sort of V-shaped recovery in Europe.
No, absolutely not. I mean, as long as Europe remained in a sort of similar growth mode as it is today, where GDP is between 1 in maybe Italy and 2.5 in other countries, I think that's a absolutely perfect playing field for the rehabilitation of the banking sector and then the interest rate play to work through.
And what is the final question before we move on to elsewhere? What is the sort of calendar that you see? Is there any sort of critical dates? You know, because often with Europe, it's sort of down to the last minute. But could this thing run over into 2019? Or do you think
I think it's possible it runs into 19, but I think, you know, most of the critical dates around the budget going to the EC at plus when they should deliver their verdict is pre-Christmas. So I think you're right. It's always dangerous to put an absolute date on it. But, you know, I suspect before Christmas we'll have a very good idea where we are in terms of this. And the last thing I'd just point out is that, you know, you should never buy anything, in my view, in terms of value, just on simple valuation. But if we're right about some of those fundamental things changing and the interest rate element, it's difficult to find a sector in the market that trades as cheaply relative to its own history, regardless of where the market is today, relative to its own history. So the bank sector is, as a whole, trades around, in Europe, trades around about just less than one times tangible book. Over time, it's traded around 1.5 times. So there is really meaningful headroom. And a lot of the stocks that we're buying are actually trading closer to half tangible book. So we really see a really nice asymmetric upside in the stocks today, which is why we're quite excited about the opportunity as we go through the end of the year.
Okay, so a great opportunity, worked well in 17, not working famously now. Now, I do want to give you an opportunity to talk about things that are working well, but another area of the portfolio that's sort of been caught up in a bit of a storm recently is your Indian positions. There is something of a non-banks financial crisis brewing, or certainly some of the headlines suggest that. Can you reveal some of the details behind the story and the, I guess, the explanation why your shares have been treated unfairly?
Yeah, I mean, look, my shares have been no more unfairly treated than others in the financial space. Look, in India, there have been a number of times over the last decade and before that where you had big sell-offs, often driven by liquidity. If you think back to late 2016, there was a very big sell-off when sort of the demonetization went on. Late 2013, a similar situation when there was sort of taper tantrum and stocks went down 20 to 50% in both those cases. We've seen a very similar thing in the last few weeks, driven by a default by an infrastructure lender in a period as you go into quarter end where liquidity is tight. I think there was quite a lot of exuberance in India overall, both in terms of the bond market and equity markets, and that kind of played into it with the sell-off that you saw, or the liquidity squeeze you saw. I'm personally not that worried about the company, or at all worried about the companies that we own. They're very well funded, they're very well capitalized, and the growth opportunity is fantastic. So as we did in 2013, as we did in 2016, we see this very much as an opportunity to pick up these stocks at very, very favorable prices. The housing finance company we own, called Indiabulls Housing Finance, now trades at 8 times earnings. We can easily see it growing at 25% for the next couple of years. It pays out half its earnings in dividends, so you carry a 5-6% dividend yield as well. And it simply doesn't have any liquidity issues. It's got $3 billion of cash on its balance sheet. It's AAA rated. It's been able to fund itself throughout the last few weeks where markets have been more difficult from a liquidity point of view. And I see liquidity coming back. Every day at the moment, liquidity has got better. The government have put in place a couple of measures that help that. But ultimately, I see the sort of market going back to where it was before. Maybe in the smaller non-bank financial companies that are less well-funded, there will remain problems. But actually, for the bigger guys, that's probably an advantage because, you know, you possibly wipe out or seriously impair some of the smaller players in the market. So, you know, these are frustrating times when these happen. You know, you never want it to happen. But ultimately, as a fund, we've done very well when we've had these pullbacks where we can see the reason for it and have been able to add to our positions.
And I mean, I guess the other thing with India, I mean, you could find a stock that's operating well and in this instance sort of been caught up in a crisis not of their own making, but at the same time, you know, you've got this, it's not a resource rich nation, has to import a lot of oil, and when the oil price is higher, it puts pressure on the budgetary deficits, and you know, that has connotations for some assets. I mean, do you just wear that risk, or do you size it appropriately, or do you put some other oil price hedges in play? Or?
Yeah, a combination of all of the above. Look, I think we've been saying for several months now that we're less enthusiastic about emerging markets as a whole. We haven't generally been putting more money to work in emerging markets for probably 3 or 4 months, given where we see the trajectory of US interest rates and the US dollar, and on the back of that, oil. But where we see long-term growth, you know, we see ourselves as, you know, medium-term investors. We want to stay invested in the best companies where the level of growth outruns effectively the risks that you have in terms of currency or in terms of valuation. So we very much stuck with India in that regard. We do have some exposure to oil-rich countries like Russia. We own a credit card company in Russia, which has been very successful for us. And we do hedge some of the currency. So we're absolutely, totally aware of the impact of rising rates, a strong dollar and oil. But, you know, sizing, positioning in other countries is very much a sort of a hedge against that.
So we talked about Europe and India, two areas of the portfolio that you believe are great opportunities, but there's no doubt there's a bit of controversy around them in terms of investor sentiment at the moment. Is there anything sort of in the portfolio that have more recently, you know, courting less controversy that are playing out as you anticipated?
Various pockets within the portfolio. I mean, we try and put together a sort of idiosyncratic portfolio, so there are sort of all, you know, hopefully always a number of different areas working well. I mean, even with all the sort of controversy in the US, and to a certain extent, the US financials haven't traded as well as some might have expected. You know, we own a couple of names there that have done well. There's an insurance company called Athene that we've been buying. It's now one of our bigger positions. It's been very successful in its acquisition strategy. We think there's further to go in that regard, and trades very, very cheaply. You know, the US has actually been very good for us this year, but we've been taking exposure from the bank sector off and rotating that into Europe, given the difference in terms of upside. So we still like the US bank sector. We have, you know, absolutely no problems with it. It's just the relative now in Europe just looks much more attractive.
And then finally, you know, you are a global fund, so you're, sort of the world is your oyster, if you like. Are there any more jewel puns or any gems in the UK that make the way into the portfolio? Or?
I mean, we've taken the view that we don't necessarily need to have a huge exposure to the UK at this point. Partly a reflection of where we see extreme value elsewhere. So we're trying to take advantage of that other value. But also, you know, we aren't politicians. We really don't know where the UK is going in terms of Brexit. So we've decided to just take a view that we can wait and see. So we still own some mid-cap stocks here in the UK where, again, we see sort of extreme levels of growth and opportunity. But with the bigger banks, we've taken the view we'll sit tight and wait, see what comes out over the next few months, and take a view from that.
Okay, well, that's that is quite a sensible strategy. I mean, Brexit's a pretty difficult one to predict and changes sort of day to day. But Johnny, thanks very much. You know, you're a very busy guy, so we really appreciate your time, and we look forward to speaking to you perhaps early in the new year to see how that European trade has worked out for you. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. But until next time, many thanks for listening.